young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Brave. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
David Roddenberry with us is the founder of Healthy Wage, the only U.S. company that pays Americans to lose weight and get fit, allowing members to bet on their ability to lose weight. He's built Healthy Wage after working in finance and realizing the tremendous opportunity to apply financial principles to our greatest public health challenge, obesity. And let's say, David, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
David, you've got to have people standing in line waiting to lose weight.
There are a lot of Americans looking to lose weight.
Okay, let me ask you this. You know, coming with your background in finance, et cetera, where was it that you got this idea? How did this get created?
Yeah, there's emerging academic literature around financial incentives for weight loss. The obesity epidemic has just continued to grow for the last 20 years, basically doubling the obesity.
Okay, so when we're dealing with it, you know, these matchup contests, the company offers various other cash rewards based on diet programs that pay participants to successfully make healthy choices. How does somebody get involved in this? And obviously, the question is, how does the company financially survive if we're paying people to join in and lose weight?
Yeah, well, we're supported financially by sponsors who are interested in addressing America's obesity epidemic. So we have the teams. In order to participate in our $10,000 team matchup competitions, the participants pay $20 a month for 3 months, and they compete for the $10,000 prize. But we also have sponsors who support Healthy Wage and healthy living.
Okay, so realistically, the idea came about, and then it started. Now, how long has it been going on?
2.5 years. We launched Healthy Wage in September of 2009.
Wow. You know, there's so many people who have lost weight. I guess really when you come down to it, weight loss has got to do with value. If the value for keeping the weight is senior to the value for losing the weight, you keep the weight. But now when we've got something called incentive, and then we're all moving in the same direction, I guess everything else kind of goes aside. We get competitive, and we lose weight.
Yeah, it's a win-win proposition if you're an insurance company or an employer. An obese person costs $1,500 a year in incremental healthcare costs. So if you can take some of that $1,500 and actually use it to pay your employee or your insured member, and they actually improve their health because of the monetary incentive, it's a win-win. You're saving on healthcare costs, and they're getting money in their pocket. And then, you know, the trick is how do you keep it off in the long term? But we're convinced that there's a financial incentive program that'll help you do that as well.
Okay, so in essence, right now, you're in a position whereby you've got the financial incentive program to lose it, and there's got to be something that will stay consistent. Have you created that secondary financial program, or is this an idea that's going to happen?
No, well, we are doing pilots with different employer groups for their employees around maintenance incentives, but we have not brought them to the public yet. So far, our current programs, we have a 10% challenge where you double your money for losing 10% of your weight over 6 months, and our matchup team contest where you compete in teams of five for a $10,000 grand prize. Both of those have been tremendously successful and effective for weight loss. So we're getting great results in terms of people losing the weight, and now with the employer groups, we're working on maintenance programs.
I mean, what a phenomenal idea. When you really come down to it, people go through weight loss programs. You know, they lose a little weight, they gain more weight, they lose some more, and they always go back to square one because for some reason it doesn't seem to work. But when you get a team program like this, and when you get employers involved in it, the people involved in it, and all of a sudden we're, you know, it's like sports. You got a team and somebody's going to win and there's a grand prize at the end of the rainbow, you'll lose some weight. What a phenomenal idea. I have heard of some great things as far as losing weight. By far, this is the best.
Oh, you're too kind, but it does appeal. You're probably like a lot of the men out there who don't do commercial weight loss programs. Their participation is 5 to 10%, and we're getting 40 to 50%. Half of our participants are male, so it's something that's appealing to a group that traditionally hasn't wanted to participate in weight management alternatives. So, and not only is it appealing to them, but they're actually losing the weight. People who are participating in our team contests is about 5% of their weight on average over 3 months. And in our 10% program, around half of the participants are successful and lose 10% of their weight over 6 months. So it's, just really, really strong results for a weight loss intervention.
Now, by the way, I look at this from an outside perspective. And when I say outside perspective, I have a fan club, and it's the I Hate Michael Ray fan club because everybody hates me. And there's a reason for that. I can eat 3 meals, 2 desserts, and lose a half a pound the next morning. So people are joining this I Hate Michael Ray fan club all the time. So every time I hear a weight loss program, what I do is the reverse, and then I put a couple pounds on them, happy.
You're one of the fortunate few out there.
No, I've got one of those metabolisms that is so rapid that I have to be real careful about, not losing weight. So when I say I think it's a phenomenal program, I'm speaking from the outside of it as an entrepreneur, as all of those things that it takes to be an American and be competitive to go out there and get it done. I think the idea is great.
Thank you. The marketplace has responded really positively. We've signed up over 250 large employer groups, including state governments, county governments, municipal school districts, and then just large companies to participate. So people are really participating and losing the weight pretty quickly. Our growth trajectory, I couldn't be more positive and enthusiastic about it. And it's because it's a simple idea. If you get a little bit of an incentive, you're going to be more successful at achieving your goal.
Now, by the way, what you've done is you've taken the basic concept of American capitalism and American, and I'm all for that. What you've done is it's the old formula: effort to reward creates the incentive, and that's really what it is, and that's what we've done from day one. When people created a business, they put an effort out, they got rewarded for the effort, the incentive was there, and they moved forward. You'll give somebody an incentive. We're in a rewards-based society. In this culture especially, when you're a kid, your mom says to you, clean up your room, we'll take you to the show. Do this, you'll get candy. Well, that's what we do. You want somebody to do something, you give them something. There's too many people out there that are struggling with weight loss, and they're struggling because nobody's paying attention, and it's hard, and they're depriving themselves. Now, all of a sudden, you've come up with an idea that says you put the effort out, you're going to get something for it, and the incentive is there, and everybody's happy because they're competing and everybody's involved, and it gives them something where they're accepted. And number two, it creates an identity.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point around the costs, unfortunately, with healthcare, the consumer doesn't bear the cost. So if I'm on high blood pressure medications and diabetes medications, I'm bearing just a very small portion of that cost, 5 or 10%, and because of the nature of the system. And so it's just not enough to motivate me bearing the negative cost of being unhealthy. So if we introduce a positive incentive and a reward, we have the potential to reverse that and really align the incentives so that me being healthy is valued and rewarded and something that's encouraged. And from a social perspective, we have to move towards that, like you were saying, kind of like your parents giving you a piece of candy for behaving well. We have to move as a society to a place where we encourage and facilitate and reward people for maintaining their health.
And by the way, let me speak your language for a moment, because when you really come down to it, when somebody experiences this program, it's a quick shot of dopamine, it feels good, and they're on it, and they're going to go get it. And I really believe that when you come down to it, neurosciences has a lot to do with this. Once somebody realizes they get that aha moment and the chemicals start, they're moving in the right direction, because the other side of that is they react and respond to something that they're going to deprive themselves with, and they drive themselves right into oblivion and obesity, and all the medical problems start and the costs go up. This way, they recognize something that's going to work for them. They recognize something they can participate in, and everything is working in the right direction.
Yeah, success begets success. So, I mean, they start responding. They see, they get, you know, the dopamine lights up, and they, you know, they get the taste of the positive incentive, and then they just want to keep going to get there.
No, absolutely. Now, by the way, is it growing? Is it growing rapidly?
Yeah. No, our you know, we're growing hundreds of percent on a month over month basis. I mean, the American consumer is really responding positively to the opportunity to get paid to lose weight, and because Healthy Wage is the only company that offers that opportunity, you know, we're just growing really rapidly. It's been just a really exciting, fun roller coaster to be a part of from a business perspective. And then the most gratifying thing is, you know, hearing the success stories as people shed the pounds and then they actually feel a lot better. You know, and that to me is the exciting thing about the program.
So, by the way, how does somebody join this? What do you do? How do matchups work?
Yeah, the matchups, it's a team of five competing for 3 months to win a $10,000 grand prize. And so they just register online at healthywage.com. If they have their team of five already, they create their team and they designate it as invitation only. But it's okay if you don't have a team of five yet. You can just register and leave it open to the public to join your team. So we encourage people to get their friends or family together so that they have a support network to participate in the contest together and make sure that they're all equally dedicated. But it's just okay if you're, you know, you want to just try it out on your own, just go to healthywage.com and sign up for the contest, and other people will join you who are, you know, excited and motivated, but maybe you don't know them already.
Okay, so in essence, though, if you decide you want to do it yourself, you don't have any friends that really have the problem that you have, then you sign up, and then people, what, in your area?
Yeah, in your area, they'll sign up as well, and they'll join your team of five, and then you'll, at the start of the contest, we partner with health clubs to verify your weight. So you'll go into a health club and just have your weight confirmed by a personal trainer, and then during the contest, you'll have things to do with your team of five to help you stay on track. So it'll be like, you know, a weekly challenge to eat out healthy, and then explain why you're eating out healthy, and win, you know, $25, $50 gift cards. So you're motivated and sustained for a full 12-week journey, and then at the end, you go back to the health club and get your weight verified, and if you're the winning team, you win the $10,000 grand prize. And there are online tools and scoreboards, so you know where you stand in the contest throughout, but, you know, at the core principle is around leveraging the team of five for support and accountability, and then, you know, having that big carrot at the end to help you motivate you and focus on your goal for the 3 month period.
And David, when is this going to hit television? I think it would be a great program. My goodness.
Well, you know, we're approached by a couple of studios, so we'll see. They're interested in taking it to the networks.
Love every second. But okay, we're running out of time. Website we can find you at where people can join up and get it going.
Yeah, it's healthywage.com, and you can sign up for either the $10,000 matchup or the 10% challenge where you double your money for losing 10% of your weight, or our BMI challenge, which pays you $100, no cost to you if you go from a obese to a healthy BMI after a year.
Wonderful, and then I get to lose people in my fan club. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Hey, David, thank you so much for joining us. Good night.
Good night.
It isn't what prohibits, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When
I think of the warm Caribbean. I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London, Siam, Vienna, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Tom Sullivan with us. We are going to be talking about stress reduction through alpha biotics. He's a practicing chiropractor, 12 years, and in his time he's treated patients from all over the world while operating his clinic in Sullivan Chiropractic, Manhattan, New York. And over his career, he's adjusted tens of thousands of people, including pro athletes, bodybuilders, actresses, actors, and the list goes absolutely on. Tom, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's lay a base and talk about alpha biotics. What are we talking about? What is that? And then we can build from there.
Okay, well, alpha biotics is a hands-on manual process, that reduces stress on both the body and the mind. Physically, after an alignment, which is what's the mode of, I guess, treatment, if you will, with alpha biotics, post-alignment, the body comes back into balance. Weak muscles become strong, strong muscles relax, structure improves itself. But also on a more of an emotional note, you're using both hemispheres of the brain. You're able to access both hemispheres of the brain, if you will, a little more easily. There's a primitive stress response by the body. When we perceive stress, we use one hemisphere of the brain or the other, and we lock it to one hemisphere of the brain or the other. Now, after that, we know that one hemisphere of the brain controls the opposite side of the body. If, for example, we lock into a left hemisphere brain dominant due to a stress response, we know that the right side of the body will become contracted. The left side of the body will become weak and passive. As a result, if this goes unchecked, physical symptoms and emotional symptoms, to be quite honest with you, are the result. Now, it's just how we deal with those symptoms at its root cause, I think, that determines the effectiveness of anyone's therapy.
Sure, Tom, let me hold you up for a minute. That's it. Let me hold you up for a minute. I walk into your office. I got a problem. I don't know what the problem is,
sure,
but I know there's a problem there. What do you do with me to be able to evaluate whether it's from the left side of the brain, the right side of the brain, and hone it down to what the problem is, and then how do we apply the fix?
That's a great question. What happens is when a person comes into the office, I simply give them a quick analysis involving some muscle testing and some postural analysis. We check the muscles on the one side of the body as compared to the other. Now, it's not a strength test. The practitioner or the doctor versus the patient, I'm not trying to overpower the patient.
Yeah.
I'm comparing the one side of the body of the patient compared to the other. There should be equal strength. If there's not, that lets me know that you might be in a stressed-out pre-sickness condition, whereas you're using the one hemisphere of the brain more than the other. And as a result, again, that body becomes out of alignment due to the unbalanced brain. So I do a quick determination as to which hemisphere of the brain you're utilizing. And then if you are an alphabetic case, if I find that you are not responding to stress appropriately, I apply what's called the alphabetic alignment unification process, which, again, is a hands-on manual process that reduces stress on the body-mind system, ultimately lateralizing the hemispheres of the brain. After the treatment, you're using both hemispheres of the brain equally, and the body just naturally comes back into alignment as a result. Physical symptoms clear themselves, and many times emotional symptoms, whether it's fatigue, mild depression, or feelings of stress, will subside as well. They've done studies where they've hooked up clients to EEG machines pre- and post-alignment, and they found that after the alignment unification process, that the brain goes into what's called the alpha wave of brain frequency. There's several frequencies of the brain waves. The alpha wave frequency is the most healing of the brain frequencies, and they found out through utilizing the EEG machines, again, that after the alignment, you're in that most relaxed state where the brain is utilizing the alpha waves. So it's a pretty unique result for both the body and the mind.
Yeah, Tom, let me talk about alignment just for a minute. This didn't happen to me, but a very close friend of mine. And by the way, I'm not a chiropractor. I'm not a clinician. I'm just outside looking in. It was a good friend of mine. He's in Southern California, and he's a swimmer. And he gets into competitive swimming all the time, gets out there with the waves and the rest of it. And what they do is they hit certain buoys, and then they, you know, they go off in a different direction. He was having a problem. The problem he was having was he could never hit the buoy. He would be, you know, a foot or two away from it, and it was causing him to lose constantly. So his wife was having some back pain. They were over at the chiropractor's office, and the chiropractor said that you're out of alignment. And Dean looked at me and said, what do you mean? He said, you're out of alignment. And if your spine isn't lined up, you're not going to be able to get the direction and the feel that you want. So he gave him a couple of sessions. He got into alignment, and all of a sudden, he's hitting the buoys, and he's going into the places that he's supposed to go. The other thing that happened, which I thought was interesting, and I've seen this over the years with people who've gone to chiropractors, our body is nothing more than a big electrochemical system. You know, our brains are, and our bodies basically do what the brain tells them to do through message units and so on and so forth. When the spine is out of alignment, there's disconnects. And when there is a disconnect, you can't get the right signals to the right places to perform properly. And I think that's what happens with a lot of people. The spine is out of alignment. It's disconnected. The brain can't send the signal down to whatever that body part is to function properly. And there's where the problems start.
I couldn't agree with you more. In the years that I've been doing chiropractic, I started doing the traditional work of chiropractic, which is the structural alignment of the spine. Then I started to really get into the philosophy and the application of the alphabiotics, and I realized that alphabiotics, as awesome as chiropractic is, I love it, alphabiotics takes it a step further. Chiropractic balances the body physically by addressing the alignment of the pelvis and the 24 bones of the spine. The alphabiotic alignment, when delivered, aligns the spine, just like chiropractic does. But like I said, it takes it a step further, and it kind of reboots the brain, the body-mind system, again, so that you're using both hemispheres of the brain equally. Because after all, when you're using one hemisphere of the brain more than the other, that's the origin of the body becoming out of alignment. So you could treat the body with traditional chiropractic, which is extremely effective, but unless you're going to take it a step further and reboot the brain to balance the brain, I find those symptoms come back again much quicker.
Sure, and it's the brain, basically.
That's where over the years I've fallen in love with that, and you know, that's the application that I utilize. But I couldn't agree with you more.
But you said something interesting about the brain automatically going into what we'll call it a fight-or-flight mechanism. The brain effectively, you get into a problem and it throws it all the way back to primitive man. You get into a problem, you stand up and fight, you lay down and play dead until the danger's over, or you run away. These are all chemicals that happen that cause this. And what happens when you get into this position, like depression. Depression is depressed, not wanting to experience something. It's part of that fight or flight mechanism. It's laying down and playing dead till the danger's over. And it's an overcompensation of the parasympathetic nervous system causing you to hide until it's all over with. Now, what's going to happen and what brings you back to this, it's your own body, your own brain that will release the chemicals that will allow you to calm back down again and get back into balance. So you're spot on with this. It's all brain chemistry.
I couldn't agree with you more. Now, the problem is these days in our time, many years ago, we weren't, let's face it, as a people, we weren't that stressed out throughout the day. We might have a fight or flight response maybe once a day.
Yeah.
The body experienced an unbalanced state, became stressed, but then you had a time to afterward. The stressful period removes itself. Your body and your mind has the time to rebalance. But in today's day and age, we're stressed out all day long. We're worried about our jobs and commuting and pollution, family responsibilities. All these things keep us in a fight-or-flight stress response the entire day. And it's much more burdensome to live in this period than it has been in the past.
And that's
where it comes into play.
Well, and it's this simple. You walk into a room, you see somebody who reminds you of somebody that you don't like, you get a shot of adrenaline, and within that just split millisecond, you're in it and you're not even thinking about it. Or you walk into the room and you see somebody cute and you like them, and all of a sudden you get a shot of dopamine, and it's a completely different resistance. we are so controlled by our brain chemistry, and thank goodness today there are people like yourself that are aware of this and can apply it practically to your profession.
Yeah, it's all about the stress response and how you, you know, in a sense, reboot the system, how you approach it. And the chiropractic alphabiotics is all great stuff. There's many different forms of healing. Some take longer than others. Alphabiotics is a very quick way to do it. In other words, a very quick way to balance the body and reboot the system. Because it's very specific. It goes right to the cause, the unbalanced brain and the unbalanced body.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's no question about it. And they really believe when you're dealing with the, you know, the left side of the brain, the right side of the brain, you've got that side of the brain that's very literal and that side of the brain that is assumptive, it's inferential. And communication has to do with that also. You can say a word, one word, and you can trigger everything that we're talking about, the dynamics of what occurs with the brain, and cause stress. It's a recognition, creates the chemical that causes the reaction, sends it through your body, and all of a sudden, you're either feeling good or you're not feeling good. And I think the greatest example of that is go into a movie and watch a movie. You get trained and skilled actors and actresses on that screen. And part of that learned skill is they know what they say and what they do is going to create a specific response. You're watching the movie, or you know, you're in love, you're angry, you're frightened, you're all of these emotions, and you know it's not real, but they're triggering these responses from you. Everything we do causes those chemical responses that have the effect on our bodies, and if the effect isn't good, healthcare costs go up.
Exactly. You know, stress is so pervasive in our society. And it's so very quick. In other words, like you just mentioned, even just watching a movie screen can initiate the stress response extremely quickly. I mean, how many times have you almost been in a car accident or stepped off the curb and saw an unexpected car coming? The adrenaline pumps up within a millisecond, and you're immediately in that stress response, that fight-or-flight stress response. So it's just so pervasive these days. Like you said, you're just walking into a room or watching a simple movie can put you in that response.
Yeah, and the other side of that...
It's all about the chemicals.
Sure, or if you hear something that looks like it's going to be a fix to a problem all of a sudden, then you get the good chemicals. And I really believe when it really comes down to it, that's what major advertisers use when they talk about the neuromarketing. They create these things that cause you to trigger those chemicals, to cause you to realize that this is something that's going to work, that cause you to take action and create what's called a buying response.
Sure. That's a huge market these days. As what little I know of it, they're hiring, apparently it's a controversial new field, but they're hiring psychologists and psychiatrists to figure out how to appeal to people to sell more product.
Absolutely.
To initiate those good chemicals and those good emotions. So yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and but the key is, it's whatever the purpose is at base, it's all the same thing. And I think a prime example of what we're talking about here would be the Nutrisystem commercial. There's a weight loss commercial on TV. On the left hand side of the screen, Tom, you see a woman maybe 80, 90, 100 pounds overweight. On the right hand side of the screen, you see the same woman. With all that weight gone, she's smiling and life is good, and the other one is looking depressed. In that millisecond of time, with that aha moment of, oh, I can do that to fix it, is every chemical that we were talking about that gets triggered, and they know exactly what they're doing. And I don't want to get into it, but it's something called a somatic marker. It's placed at the right time in the right place to trigger that in somebody where they go, oh, they change the brain chemistry, and they control the actions.
Sure.
Yeah,
chemistry is obviously very important. One of the stress hormones that is released when a person perceives stress, again, stress is physical, chemical, or emotional, is cortisol. And just referring to what you just spoke of, cortisol being a stress hormone also affects, dictates how much weight you're going to hold on to and how much weight you're going to gain. So stress is pervasive. It's not just a chemical, which we did, you know, just spoke about. It's also the emotional and the physical. So it's just pervasive. It's everywhere these days.
Yeah, no question about it. No, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, we got about a minute or so. We're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this.
Okay.
You talk about stress. Well, if you're in New York and I'm in Milwaukee or somewhere else, how do we connect with you? Because obviously you can't you can't work with everybody all over the all over the country. What do you do? How do you connect with?
Sure, sure. Well, yeah. I'm available for phone consultation or email consultation through my website, which is www.destressnyc.com. Or you can go to our corporation's main site, which is alphabeticinfo.com. And on that website, you can find a practitioner in your area, and they can help you just the same way that I can.
Oh, okay. So there's actually practitioners all over the country.
All over the country. All over the country.
Oh, wonderful.
Where it's a growing...
Great.
I'm sorry?
Oh, no. I said great.
Yeah, it's a growing field. We started in about 1971. It's a relatively new profession. And at this stage of the game, I think we're in almost about 35 to 40 states. So there's a good chance there's an alphabetic practitioner near you that can help.
Wonderful. Hear you loud and clear. Hey, Tom Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me. I hope I answered some of your questions.
Oh, you bet you did. Okay, and thank you, and good night.
Okay, take care.
Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. We're going to have some fun right now. Master Energy Health Practitioner Angela Busio is with us. She's the co-author of the best-selling book, How Do You Do That? She's the creator of the Turn Stress to Success online program, as well as the newly launched RealStressSolutions.com and Inbox Magazine. And she's a radio show host on the Women's Information Network and has a thriving personal life coach practice. Angela, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed listening to Tom's comments. It sounds like if you have stress, this is the place to be tonight.
No, absolutely. If I can get out of the stress of doing the show, I'll be fine. But when you, there are so many people that have so much stress today. And when we talk about energy health, that's really what it's about, isn't it? When we have energy, our body's run by energy, our mind is run by energy, the universe is run by energy. And when we get out of balance, big problems, huh?
Well, I'll say, and really, you know, that's really the definition of stress, Michael, is when we are out of balance some way. And there's lots of ways to get out of balance, but certainly all of the ways that we can get out of balance, whether they come from outside, you know, there's toxic pollution, there's nutritional things that we can eat that are poisonous for us, but they certainly all do affect our energy at the end of the day. And most importantly, they affect where our energy goes, because where attention goes, energy flows. And when we're having stress, that's where all of our energy and attention is going. And that's what I'm trying to help people is learn to do, is to recycle or reclaim the energy that's going towards stress, to put it towards the things that they want to do rather than just managing their stress symptoms.
No, realistically, when you think about it, everything you said is so spot on. because you have to put energy into stress. You have to create the stress. So you know, like, quote unquote, when I say you, me, individually, we're the ones who do it based on how we choose to respond to what goes on in our world. So if we can create it, we can also uncreate it and recreate anything we want. But I think the missing link, Angela, is how do you do that?
Well, you know, Michael, Descartes, who is one of a person who actually caused a lot of disenlightenment in the world, actually said something very enlightening, which was that awareness is the cure. And until we wake up and are conscious of how we create stress in our body, then we really are at we're victims of our own body chemistry and things that are happening around us. And I always like to tell people, you know, your cat will never have an ulcer, or you never meet a hippo with an ulcer. And, you know, it kind of goes back to what you were saying, that as humans, we actually can create stress when there is nothing to be stressed about. You know, an animal is only stressed out when they really need to be. You know, when they've got a lion chasing them, is going to eat them for dinner, then they turn on the stress response and it works well for them, and they actually exert and process all the chemistry of stress, all the toxic hormones that are pumped out, you know, norepinephrine, adrenaline. They're really pretty toxic for your body. They use that up when they're running away from the lion. But, you know, we sit on our couch or in our beds at night and we pasteurize. We go into the past or we futurize. We make up stuff to be upset about. We create false emergencies. And that's where we need to start waking up and saying, hey, I can control this because I can control what I'm thinking about right now.
Sure. And it's also making the distinction between then and now. I think my favorite story about this, and I probably tell it 100 times a week, if not 200 times a week, but it's when I was 8 years old. Everybody in the room's going, oh God, here we go again. But I was 8 years old. I'm standing in front of the mirror. I got my cowboy hat on. I got my toy guns. I'm playing and I'm screaming and yelling and having the greatest time in the world. Well, my dad walked in and he laughed at me, shut me right off, totally humiliated and embarrassed me. And as an 8 year old, that was the last time that I ever played in front of the mirror out loud. I can still see it. Now, as an adult, I got it. I work with this stuff all the time. But as a teenager, you didn't laugh at me. You didn't talk down to me. You dared, did not humiliate me. There would have been a fight. There would have been an argument. There would have been something. And basically what you're really dealing with is an unconscious activation of a memory triggering a recognizable association or experience unconsciously, triggering a reaction. And in today's world, people can be laying in bed. Somebody might walk in, say something, smile, not smile, and it triggers that reaction because she looked like that, he looked like that, this is what they said, and all of a sudden you're reliving it, and all those chemicals are flowing.
I am so glad that you brought that up, because really I think it's one of the core causes of our stress are our subconscious patterns. And, you know, Michael, unfortunately, even the most conscious person on this planet is running 95% of the time on those unconscious patterns. And it's just how the brain has evolved to work, because it takes a lot of fuel. When you're conscious, it takes a lot of sugar to run your brain. So, you know, it has evolved in a way so that the brain doesn't have to be conscious and doesn't need as much fuel. And the way that it's evolved by that is by the things that we see and do repetitively over and over, the brain makes a program. The brain makes a little road for that. And unfortunately, we can make roads for not just things like driving or riding a bicycle, which is a really good example of a pattern. But unfortunately, especially from the ages 2 to 8, we are in an alpha-theta state in our brain, which is in a record mode. So especially the things that we have traumatic experiences around, especially repetitively over and over again, those are the roads that get into our brain. And those patterns are triggered by stimulus response, just like you said. They're by sights, sounds, smells, the things we see. And we're getting triggered all day long into our patterns. And you'll know if you're triggered in a pattern, if you've just said your affirmations and are trying to be as positive as you can, and all of a sudden you don't feel good. Something's happened in the room that has triggered you into a stressful response. So the best we can do until we really learn to reprogram those patterns, which is what I like to teach people to do, is to reframe what's happening, be aware that it's happening, and then somehow process the emotions and the stress that's happening, and then reframe it somehow in the way that we would rather have. And if you reframe it enough times, Michael, it starts to make its own road, and then it will run on automatic, just like the old patterns did, which is really exciting, don't you think?
Oh, sure, sure. And I think reframing it is an extremely important word. You mentioned something about affirmations. There's a dialectic pattern that you can use. In the old way of doing an affirmation, and when I say old way, we're talking 100 years ago, that somebody would say, you know, I feel good, I'm really great, and I'm a wonderful person. Well, for the most part, somebody who's not feeling too good is not going to believe that. So what they would do is you'd take the affirmation and I'm really a great person. And then you'd get another column next to it, and the first thing that pop up in your mind would say, no, I'm not. I'm a great person. You don't deserve to be a great person. And you get all this stuff out. And then when you finally get it out, then you recreate it into such a way that the mind will accept it. Like, well, it's okay to begin to learn how to be a nice person. And then all of a sudden, it's manageable, it's acceptable, it's something that you could wrap your arms around and do. And just like you said, I'll say in a different way. And you repetitiously do it, then all of a sudden you become it.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of times when we're saying affirmations, we have what we call a psychological reversal, which means that the belief system in our body is so strong about, let's say, I'm stupid, that when we say, I'm so smart, there is a filter there that says, no, you're not. And, in fact, you don't even know who you are unless you are dumb. And so we have what we call resistance. And there's some really cool ways that we can get around that psychological reversal. And one of the ways is by saying things like, what if I could be a smart person? Or I choose now to be a smart person. And so that's one of the ways that people can get around when they notice that they have this negative talk, or when they notice that they're not being able to, or they're having a lot of resistance. So, and that's a serious problem, and it causes people to not be able to change, even though they're trying as hard as they can.
Now, by the way, I'm looking at you, and I think there's something great on here. I'm looking at your press release, and it's got the 5-minute stress solution, and it's got one side of this, whatever, it's got a little smiley face, and it's got the nasty face on it. And there are things that people have said for years, that there are people who will look at a smiley face, and all of a sudden, their mood changes. And one of the reasons for that, you've got very specialized brain cells. They're called mirror neurons, and they're in the emotional part of your brain. It's just part of your internal communication structure. What it does, it fires up when you see or you hear something that you recognize, and you emotionally mirror, you mimic that action in your mind. And if you can see a smiley face, your mind will actually mimic it, and it can make you feel good. That old adage about laughter is the best medicine, what happens when you laugh, your brain releases endorphins. Makes you feel good, calms you down. And when you hear something or see something that looks like it's a fix to something, some kind of a solution to a problem, you start to release this stuff. And that's really what triggers all of these mechanisms that we talk about. What you see triggers a chemical, and the chemical controls everything that goes on in your brain and body.
Exactly. And, you know, I always like to tell people that because sometimes words just aren't enough, a lot of times it's good to create a holographic image of something. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm trying to help someone reframe something, I'll say, let's think about, say they're feeling unworthy. And I'll say, well, let's think about a time, was there ever a time in your life when you did feel worthy? And then I have them recreate that situation in their mind. What did it look like? What did it smell like? What did it taste like? Was there a taste? What did you hear? What are the things? Until they can really, really get that in their mind. And it's amazing what can happen when you can engage all the senses that way to help reframe or to turn things around.
No, absolutely. No question about that. And most people, I would like to say want that, but I'm going to go back to dumb, okay? Dumb can be an identity for people, because as long as I'm dumb, then I'm going to get people to pay attention to me. As long as I'm a loser, they'll pay attention to me. As long as I fail, that's the way I get my attention. Those are the things that have to be completely reversed. And I think the big problem we have in communication is, you know, you could say rhetorically, what does love mean? What does security mean? What does happiness mean? And more important, to who? And that's where the key is. There's got to be common ground.
Well, we certainly all have our own thesaurus, don't we, for what every word means.
Sure.
And it is a difficult situation, and it's hard to stay aware. And certainly there are benefits for being dysfunctional. You know, when we're sick, we don't have to go to school. When we're, you know, I've seen a lot. I had a daughter who had a lot of chronic illness, and we really had to work hard on, you know, am I willing to give up the benefits? And through the new energy methods that are available, there's some really amazing ways that you can reverse, do a lot of psychological reversals on a lot of those issues. And that's why I get excited about, in particular, energy psychology or energy methods, because they kind of transcend the conscious part of our brain and kind of go right to speaking to some of the unconscious patterns and belief systems that keep us stuck.
Oh, absolutely. Let me take words to just a little bit different level. I won't get stuck on it here, but every word that you speak has a corresponding image based on your own experience. If I were to say to you, chamber around, do you know what that means?
Chamber around?
Yeah, do you know what that means?
I see a like a congressional chamber or a legal chamber, something like that.
Okay. But what if I said... there was a man with a gun and he was putting the bullet in the gun. He was chambering around. Now all of a sudden there's a different image. If you say chamber around means put a bullet in a gun. But the point is, if you're not familiar with the words, then it has no mental image. And if it has no mental image, it goes right over your head. You, me, anybody. And that's where I think the importance of words are. It's the matching of the image to the word. And that's what communication is all about. It's recognition.
Absolutely. And learning to speak in ways that people can understand. And that certainly does take time. And when we speak that way, we also speak to other people's neurons, mirror neurons, and we have much more influence with them as well. So good point, Michael.
No, I completely agree. Okay, the 5-minute stress solution, the phone app, the desk widget, what do we do? How do we get it?
It is going to be launching very soon. Unfortunately, iPhone changed all their parameters, and my programmer had to kind of rewrite the language. And so we're in pre-launch mode. I would love to have people come and get educated about it at www.stress-4-success.com. You can...
We lost her. We lost her. But let me continue on for a minute or two. Maybe she'll call back. But what we're talking about realistically is some of the pitfalls that you fall into when you're not realizing there are different ways to manage stress. The problem is this. It's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you don't know that you don't know. And there are people like Angela, and there are people that have expertise in these certain areas. They can look over your shoulder and they can see what you don't see. It's called that blind spot. That blind spot is that spot that whatever it is you're missing that would create a solution for whatever the problem is at that point. And so those blind spots get filled up. Just because we're a human being and we've gone through a certain amount of school or academic, we have this academic wisdom, whatever the case may be, does not mean that you happen to know about every subject that there is, and there's a tremendous amount of stuff out there that we don't know about. There's a rule that I have lived with for many, many years now, and that rule basically is this. A good teacher knows when to be a student, and a good leader knows when to follow. And it's changing hats every day of the week, or sometimes every hour. There are times when it's time to learn, there's times when it's time to teach, there's times when it's time to lead, and there's times when it's time to follow. And what that does, that allows you to balance the stress because you know you don't have to be as healthy. Ah, Angela, good, we got you back.
Yes, sorry about that.
Oh, that's...
Obviously, the phone lines are having some stress tonight.
That was stress.
But yeah. Do you want me to continue with the invitation to my newsletter?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, I would love to have you join my Real Stress Solutions family. And from there, I'll be launching all my products and programs. And there's also other great, really great 21st century solutions that are available at that site. And that's at www.realstresssolutions.com. So I would love to have you join. And if you go, you'll also be able to download a free 60-page ebook called The Mind Map of Stress Management that will help you know the five different areas that you have to keep balanced in order to really manage your stress. So I'd love to get to know some of your audience, Michael, and really invite you to join me.
What, and how do we find you? How do we find your show?
My show is at the Women's Information Network. It's I think, www.thewinonline.com. And my show on that network is called Awake and Aware. And if you just go to the show host there, you can find me there. And there's a whole archive of shows that are there. That's not a live show. That's just an archive of shows that I've done in the past. I'd love to have you join me there as well.
Great. Angela, hey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michael. And create a great day.
Absolutely. Good night.
Okay, good night.
We'll warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Kevin McCarney with us. He's the author of The Secrets of Successful Communication. He's the founder of the Poquito Moss restaurant chain, which opened in 1984 and turned it into a $15 million a year business with 12 locations serving over 4,000 customers every day in the Los Angeles area. Based in Burbank, California, the restaurant specializes in fresh Mexican food. And because each restaurant produces over 900 tortillas a day, Kevin invented an aluminum tortilla press, a machine on which he holds multiple patents. He's been a guest speaker at USC Marshall School of Business, UCLA Anderson School of Business, Woodbury University. He served on the board of directors of the California State Compensation Insurance Fund, the California Restaurant Association, the Burbank Arts Education Foundation, and the Boys and Girls Club of Burbank, and the Universal City North Hollywood Chamber of Commerce. My goodness, Kevin, in your spare time, what do you do?
That's a long intro. Thank you. In my spare time, I spend it with my family, and I spend it writing.
Then I hear you. And by the way, thank you so much for being here. Secrets of Successful Communication. There are so many people who think they're communicating, and the other person on that other side of that of the desk or the microphone, whatever the case may be, has no idea what that person is talking about, even though they're speaking the English language. Now, you're talking about the big and the little brain. How does it work? What are we talking about here?
Thank you, Michael. It's the big brain is that smart, diplomatic, positive, thoughtful brain that's going to say the right thing at the right time, every time. And the little brain, which is right next to your mouth, is going to spit out that impulsive, overreacting, sarcastic, and sometimes careless comment exactly at the wrong time. And that's the one that gets us in trouble, and the big brain has to come back and kind of clean up that communication mess.
Okay, so essence, we're talking about the brain that either opens his mouth and says, oh, did I really say that, or the brain that says, let's wait and count to 10 before we talk.
Yeah, it is. It's almost a think before you speak, but it's what we've done is we've made it very easy for people to identify when they're using which brain. It's when they're using their little brain, and if you hear something come out of your mouth, you go, I probably shouldn't have said that. You can quickly retort it and come back and apologize for it. And, you know, your big brain, though, will be thinking before you go into the conversation, what's this conversation going to be about, and what do I want out of this conversation? What are the results? And then they'll be driving the conversation toward those results.
You know, I come from a world, and I was brought up in the Los Angeles area. As a matter of fact, I came from the most famous city in Southern California.
Which, you ready for this? That's got to be Burbank.
No, it's got to be Bell. Everybody's going to jail there.
Oh. I apologize. I was thinking the old Johnny Carson days. Bell is extremely popular right now.
No, absolutely.
Famous, well, I saw, not popular.
You know, I saw that and I thought, oh my goodness, how it's changed. I was brought up there. I went to grammar school, junior high school in Bell, California, 360 years ago too. But we spoke completely different in those days, and I really believe, and I know you address this, that communication in and of itself has been transformed. You know, these kids text, they use they use their computers and their iPods and their Blackberries and everything else constantly. We seem to have lost that human touch.
Well, you know, that's a brilliant point. And I tell you what you've hit it right there, and that is that these communication tools, the smartphones, the used to be pagers, but everything we have right now with IMing and Facebook and Twitter, you know, we don't have time to think anymore before we react and spit out a comment. And it's happening with kids where they're texting back and forth, and then you find kids having issues with other kids because they texted something that was emotional in the moment and they didn't wait for a moment. And then one of the things they need to really, you know, that I'm trying to help kids with is to understand that once you push send today, that message belongs to somebody else. It's on somebody else's computer. It's on Facebook's database. It's on somebody else's iPhone. And that will be there for the rest of your life. And where, Michael, you and I may have a past, the kids growing up today, their past is present every moment on the computer.
Oh, sure. And no, absolutely no question about it. And I really believe that the problem would be also in parents communicating with their kids today. When I was a kid, my mom, I was a scrappy kid. My mom was only 5 foot tall. I didn't use a four-letter expletive in the house. And if she said something, I did it. That was the end of it. You didn't fight back. But these kids today are, quote unquote, so smart that they're smarter than their parents in their own mind. And that, in and of itself, is one of the greatest barriers to communication that we have.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that I see over and over again, and from a parenting aspect, and even from a chaperoning and a coaching aspect, is, you know, parents really overreacting to that natural teenage years that their kids are going to have, and because kids, especially when they're teenagers, believe that they know everything. And they're going to
speak with a tone that's probably not going to be the right tone a lot of the times. And I see parents overreacting to the adolescent phase that the kids are going through, and then they join their kids in that kind of a tone war where they, you know, they kind of out-tone each other. Somebody says, well, that's not what you said. Well, that's what you meant. And they escalate into an argument that didn't need to happen, because the parents just take a couple key lessons on this one with tone is in the moment, in the pressure of the moment, and kids are going to make 100 mistakes a year.
Oh, sure.
That's just natural. I've got two daughters, and I have lots of kids around me, and they're going to make 100 mistakes a year. The every time we react or respond to one of their mistakes, that's parenting, and it's either good parenting or it could be better parenting. And so the number one rule, don't overreact in the moment when the kid makes a mistake. Lots of times they realize they made a mistake, and we don't need to pile on. Don't take it personally when they're using the wrong tone, which is going to happen quite a bit in their teenage years, and don't follow them into that tone, because it's just going to create an argument. You know, I had a friend whose son lost his bike. I should say he's lost. It was stolen. And brand new bike. The kid felt awful. Dad got the call, goes home. He's walking up the stairs to talk to the kid about, you know, all the things you can possibly launch with. Why didn't you lock it? Why didn't you put it there? Why did you walk away from it? Everything in his mind that he was going to say. But when he got to the top of the stairs, he looked at the kid, and the kid was so dejected that he just looked over and said, listen, it happens to all of us, you know. Yeah. And he walked up, and he gave him a big hug, and he says, hey, it's just a bike. That's a great parenting moment, because what it did is it built trust between those two. And instead of overreacting with all the standard cliche lines that we can use as to parenting, he looked at the situation and realized that he'd just be piling on if he said anything.
No, sure. And there's another thing to take into consideration, because when you were talking about tone, words in and of themselves, you've got three ways to look at a word. You got the dictionary definition. That's the literal definition. Then you've got the definition plus the connotation, the underlying meaning based on whose ever experience it was. But then you've got something else when you talk about tone, the state of mind of the receiver. That's where the problem is. You walk into the room, your wife's got a new outfit on, and you say, boy, you look good today. She's in a good mood. She says, thank you. Something happened that morning, and she's in a horrible mood. You walk in, and you say, boy, you look good today, and you're in trouble.
Yeah. And you know what? It's true. It's going to happen. You understanding the influences that the people are under at the moment, and especially in that situation, not taking it personally, that, you know, there's something else going on here. It has nothing to do with what you said. That awareness factor of recognizing that's not really the response I was expecting, so there must be something else going on. And don't take it personally, and just be aware of that moment. And it's a really good point, Michael, because when you are somebody, you get a reaction from somebody you're not expecting, that's a good chance that there's something influencing them a little bit more. They might be using more of a little brain reaction than we might expect.
No, absolutely. And there's something that you deal with, and it's your 10th talking point, and I think this is one of the most critical things that we can look at. Most people have no idea what, you know, in the next 5 or 10 years, you know, they say, I'm this way today, how am I going to be? There was something that you can do if you project out ahead 15, 20, 25 years from now, and you're at a dinner party, and the dinner party is in your honor, and you write down what you want everybody to say about you at that dinner party. Now you've got 10 or 15 years to become that. And one of the things that you're talking about is legacy. And legacy, and you're absolutely spot on right. Most people, they think it's something that you leave behind is when you die. Called create it now. You have total control over it.
Really, really good, Michael. Thank you. Legacy is it. And we're living today the legacy of what we said yesterday and what we said a week ago and a month ago. And it's a great concept you bring up between the difference between a roast and a toast. And I think that, you know, if you look into the future, don't look too far. Just look to next week and look at the conversations you're having today and how they're going to impact when you're dealing with coworkers, when you're dealing with employees, when you're dealing with family. You know, what you say today will resonate tomorrow. And, you know, I think that one of the great things about a legacy is you're building trust in a legacy. Every time you speak, it adds to your trust or takes it away. If you're using your big brain, you're definitely adding to it. If you're using your little brain, it just takes away people's ability to trust you as much. You know,
sure.
And you know, I think if we all make mistakes, no one's perfect. We're going to use our little brain once in a while. And if we do, that's okay, because the good thing is there's no expiration date on an apology. And,
yeah.
You know, if we say something wrong this week, it's okay to next week to call somebody and say, hey, you know what, maybe I was drinking a little bit too much, or I had too much, or I was under pressure from my boss, and I probably overreacted to that situation. Take away that negative legacy at any time. There's a great story about a girl who was bullied quite a bit in elementary school, and she went on Facebook. And on Facebook, the bullies who were bullying her found her and apologized 20 years later for what they had done. And I love that story because it's just so true that there is no expiration date. And it also lets us know that if we do make a mistake and if we do use our little brains, we can make up for it.
No, absolutely. And there's also something called, and you were talking about it with the kids, it's called pay attention, especially with parents and kids today. You know, we live in such a fast-paced, microwavable, high-energy world today. We forget to take a look. There was an old movie called Our Town, and I will never forget. There was a scene in it where the young woman she wasn't young, but she had died. She'd gone to heaven, and they gave her a gift. They allowed her to come back on her 10th birthday, and so she came back to Earth on her 10th birthday, and she was dressed up, and she had her birthday dress on, and she was looking good, and she came running down the stairs, and her dad was at the bottom of the stairs, and she said, "Daddy, look at me." She said, "It's my birthday. Look at me. I'm all dressed up." And he said, "Don't bother me right now. I got to go make money to pay for this." And she comes down in the kitchen, and her mom is there, and she said, "Mom, look at me. Look at this." And her mom looked at her and said, "But don't bother me right now. I'm making a birthday cake for you for the party, etc." And then she stopped for a while, and she had a tear in her eye, and she looked back up in heaven, and she said, I want to come back. It's too tough down here."
Wow. Yeah, that's a wonderful story, Michael. That's and that's so key to the point, is that those moments that she experienced with that could have been so different.
Yeah.
Had the parents themselves recognized that this was a moment that they wanted to be proud of. I know that, my daughter walked down the stairs one time, and she was in this really wild outfit that she wanted to show me because of a play she was in. And I looked at it, and I immediately started critiquing. And,
yeah.
and she looked at me, and she turned around, she went back upstairs. And I realized, walking back upstairs, oh, my gosh, she wanted me to be enamored with this outfit. She didn't want me to critique it. And
yeah.
I lost that moment, but I immediately went back and I just said, you know what, I'm sorry. That was my fault. I apologize. But your story is so perfect for this concept, because it is that awareness of the moment. It is being there.
Yeah, yeah. And that also is communication. How many times do we get into conversations with someone and you're there with that person, but you're not there? You're 20 minutes ahead or you're 2 hours behind, and they experience it. And I think that's the one thing that if everybody would take the concepts of what you have here and what you have in the book and what you're teaching and apply it to their own lives, I think there would be a lot of problems that wouldn't have to happen in this world today, because it all lies in somebody accepting someone else, accepting the way they talk, accepting their concepts or ideas, or how they are, or quote-unquote, the dress that might have been strange going to school in, but it was great for the play. And I really believe that's one of the things we're starting to miss today.
Yeah, and it's true, and I think that's why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I saw too many relationships falling apart because people would fall into these little traps and over and over, and each time they did, it would have an impact on the relationship. And so, in studying all this stuff, I really want to focus on just helping people in their everyday life communicate a little bit better, getting a little bit better at what they do, and helping myself, too, get a little bit better at communicating.
Yeah, and I think there's a very important rule that everybody should put up on their walls, get T-shirts, and et cetera. It's not what you say, it's what they hear that makes or break you. The communication is not about what you're saying, it's about what they're hearing.
That's so key, and that's really recognizing that you're in a conversation that is a dialogue between two people and not a monologue with just one person speaking. And I think that you hit it right there. That's a perfect illustration.
Yeah, Kevin, we're just about out of time now. Website, we can find you at, get the book, find out what else you're doing.
Sure. Thank you, Michael. It's bigbrain.com, and it's not because I'm a big brain. It's because I want people to look at using their big brains more often, but it's bigbrain.com.
Yeah. Now, by the way, La Cienega, which is obviously still there, I don't know if Restaurant Row is there anymore. Is that gone, or is that still there?
There's a couple restaurants still there. It's still technically Restaurant Row. It's changed a little bit. Some of the restaurants have changed, but it's still here, and there's still some great food there.
Do you know what the...
Lowry's is still there.
Oh, really? Do you know what the literal translation of La Cienega is?
Oh, that's a good question. I should know the answer to that, but I do not know.
Let me give you the answer. You may not want to tell
anybody.
I'll give you the answer. Restaurant Row is the name of La Cienega means the sewer.
Oh.
So we'll keep that secret. Well,
again, one of those words that's maybe lost in translation.
I gotcha. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate the work that you're doing.
Michael, thank you, and I really love your show.
Great. Thank you. Good night.
You feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you're always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days, I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days. When you feel all blue, you're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you for you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Anna Cuevas with us. She's known as America's loan modification guru. She's the number one best-selling author and has guided thousands of Americans in keeping their homes from foreclosure, a popular blogger, and she's been called a superhero of the loan modification industry and has been nominated for CNN's Heroes. She's the author of Save Your Home Without Losing Your Mind or Your Money. Anna, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, in today's world, there are so many people losing their homes. There's so many people confused about it. I have known people who have lost their homes, but it might have taken them a year, year and a half before they actually had to give the home up. And in that period of time, each time the person that one of the people that I know would call to get some information, it was turned over to another loan operation, and that person could never get any idea of what was going on, because it was always, it always belonged to somebody else and the information wasn't there. How do you move through all of those things?
I believe that the first thing that people need to do is be completely prepared with their own paperwork and understand the complete process and the guidelines for the program that they're applying for. And then that way, what they could do is escalate their case. After they've gone through the first round and they can't seem to get anywhere, then you need to escalate your case to the next level. And then there's always a level above and above that you take this to until you start involving other people, such as your congressman and your senator and the treasury and whoever else you need to get involved to save your home from foreclosure.
Sure. You know, one of the things that I've thought about over the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years when this has really came to the forefront is basically this. You get a bank, and especially in the economic times we're having today, you get a bank and the bank forecloses on a house. Okay, so great. They foreclose on the house. They don't negotiate with the person to maybe to bring down the payments, to do something about the actual cost of the home. So now they've got the home back and it sits because now they can't find anybody with the credit to buy the house. That's an interesting place that they're in. And I'll bet, and I don't know this for a fact, so I'm just betting, I would bet there's a tremendous amount of homes that are sitting there empty that the banks can't do anything with.
Oh, definitely there is. And there's another sad story that I read recently about some of the banks giving away some of those foreclosed homes to nonprofit organizations. Could you imagine when they could have actually helped the homeowner that was there to keep the home? They're giving it away, and then they come back and sound like they're heroes because they're giving the homes away to nonprofit organizations. How sad is that?
Unbelievable. I mean, realistically, there's got to be something that's going to be a commonality of approach that everybody can use at this stage of the game, because there are people out there that don't deserve to lose their homes. Yes, they got into some financial problems. Yes, there were homes that were sold to people who they knew they couldn't afford them in the first place. I mean, that's a tragedy in and of themselves. But for the most part, a lot of the people who, if they would have negotiated, at least the home wouldn't have had to sit by itself. It wouldn't have had been given away, and somebody could have kept their house.
Right, I completely agree, and that's where I come from, is the fact that people need to empower themselves with enough information to fight back. Because even some of those homes that are sitting there vacant now, if the homeowner would have had certain information in their hands, then they could have taken that information and done what I say is go up and fight and escalate to the next level. I have seen several cases, I'm talking about a high percentage of about 90% of the declines that I've seen are things that people can go and fix and fight back and then turn that whole thing around and get their loan modification approved. So I'm seeing a great, great number of success when people are prepared with the right information.
Now, have the banks done it the right way? And Anna, when I say have they done it the right way, as you were talking, I got to thinking about this. Let's say, for instance, somebody fell into that trap and they lost their home. But did the banks do the right thing? Did they cross their T's? Did they dot their I's? Did they make sure they were within whatever banking laws that allowed them to do it and they didn't step aside? Is there anything that a homeowner who's lost a home can go back and sue a bank about?
You know, I'm not an attorney, so it's hard to get into that whole piece of it, because the HAMP, you know, the Home Affordable Modification Program, there isn't any laws that enforce that and that make that servicer or that lender have to do it and have to comply by all of the rules, even though they sign all of these different servicer agreements with the program, with the Treasury. I've seen people try to fight some of those things, and all they end up is thousands and thousands of dollars later still in the same position that they started off being in. So I believe that if people go into this as prepared as possible, then if you're able to still be in the home and still have that title in your name, it's easier to fight on that level than it is on the other side of it. Although I have overturned over 14, maybe even 20 now, foreclosure sales, I've helped people get those homes back in their names due to errors that were done. That is possible. It's a lot of hard work. You have to give up your day job and everything else to get it done, but it is possible. On certain occasions, if you find that there's an error that's been made and the property hasn't been purchased by a third party, if it went back to the lender, you can take that up the chain of command and, you know, maybe call in some news media or something to come in, and you are able to overturn it on certain occasions. If everything's right, all of the conditions have to be there.
And I'm a very strong believer in communication. And in communication, there is a language. Now, and when we speak language, it's not necessarily language of a country. It's the language of a business. There is a legal language. There is a language if you're going to have a baby. There's a language if you're going to buy a house. Every field, every facet of every field has a language. And I bet the biggest problem that most people have is they don't understand the language, the legal language, the real estate language. And these poor people get lost totally. And because they don't understand it, because they don't quote-unquote speak it, they lose their houses.
Oh, yes, exactly. That is the precise reason why I've included a complete glossary in the book, so people can feel confident when they call. And instead of receiving a letter that says, you have been declined for negative NPV, and people are going, oh, my God, what is NPV, right? Now you're able to look at that, read all about what NPV means, so that if you happen to get that letter, you know exactly what that means. And instead of feeling kind of dumb, I mean, they may almost make you feel very small and dumb and insignificant because you don't know any of these things. And here's the saddest part. Sometimes the employee of the bank doesn't even know what it means. So sometimes the homeowner could call and say, what does this mean? I've been denied for NPV. And then they'll say, oh, it's because your home isn't worth enough money. And actually, that's the wrong answer. It has nothing to do with that. It's actually the opposite. So it's interesting. All of the different scenarios that people have come to me with, ranging from talking to the lender to talking to Hope, talking to a nonprofit organization, there's just different variations of the interpretations of the guidelines, and a lot of them are completely wrong.
Now, the other thing, and I know you addressed this, and I'm sure it's addressed in the book, is that the options that people have. There's a homeowner that the only thing that they say to them is, you're going to lose your house. That's the only option. It's over with. And that's not true. And the homeowner, quote-unquote, not knowing the language or where to look or how to understand what they're dealing with, feel like they have no option, and they lose the home, and they didn't have to lose the home. I know you do cover that in the book.
Yes, definitely. And what happens is that a lot of times they're even steered by the real estate agent saying their only option is short sale. Another thing that happens is at the first decline, right when you get declined, the next letter that goes out is, do you want to apply for a short sale? And, so people are, get this letter that says, do you want to apply for a short sale, right after they get the letter that says that you've been denied. And unfortunately, I don't know if it's because we were raised, from the Industrial Revolution, where we're all kind of these, round pegs and square holes or whatever, and we just have to, do all of these things and conform to the way business was set up. But nobody questions if the answers that they're getting are accurate, because we are raised that, if we're talking to the bank and the bank says that we're denied, then we must be denied. And that's it. Let's start packing our bags and let's go. And I come from a different mentality. I learned from my mother who said, she learned from an FBI agent who told her, Maria, when you're in this country, there's always somebody that you can escalate something to the next level, to the next level. If you know that what you're fighting for is reasonable, then you can fight back. And that has been what has saved all of these thousands of people that have come to my site from losing their homes.
Now, by the way, it's the homeowner. The homeowner to be able to, and I don't even like the word educated, equipped, armed with the information that they can stay ahead of the banks. You get something that says that the short sale, the rest of it, and all of these things that confuse people. If you know what's going to come ahead of time, you can anticipate it, and if you can anticipate it, you can fix it before it happens.
Yes, exactly. I like to call it empower, because if you're empowered with that information before, then let's say you know what your numbers look like and you know how they fit into the guidelines, then you don't have to stay up all night wondering if you're going to get approved, because you know that the likelihood is pretty high that you're going to get approved because you're fitting into the parameters. Now, you might put your numbers in and realize that you're not fitting into the parameters, but the, you know, they are what they are. So you go ahead and you send it in, but you already know that they don't fit into the parameters. So now you can start finding some extra income, maybe, you know, picking up that hobby that can make you a little extra money, or, you know, you're going to know how short you are. You might want to shop your insurance and raise your deductible, or lower your tax basis. If you've seen other properties that have gone down in value, contact your county to lower your tax basis. But you know ahead of time, so you can start being proactive with these other things. So if the denial comes, well, guess what? Now you've got all these other ducks in the row, and you can go back in and reapply with the new information.
Now, by the way, you began as a banker, and when you were working in the banks, did the banks take the same attitude that they did in the last 3 or 4 years? Has the banking industry in and of itself changed?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's obviously tightened up completely, but I could see exactly what happened is, you know, back when the mortgage-backed securities were sold as forwards and they were sold in advance of the actual mortgages existing, I noticed the change where it opened up and more money was flowing freely. You know, you could send out, there's a joke that you can send your dog in with a note and he would get a mortgage loan. And, you know, it's pretty much like it was. There was, you know, no doc, no asset, no this. You know, based on your credit score, you can, you know, finance your property. And obviously that's really tightened up after, you know, it's really hit. You know, not only our country, but all the other countries that are also taking a hit because everybody wanted in on this casino game.
Sure. And basically what they would do, and realistically, you know, if you look at the banks, you look at people, you follow the money. I really think that's what we have to say. You take 10 mortgages that the bank had. They packaged it up and they sold it off. Then the package was created by putting other packages of houses together, and that got sold off. And by the time that it all got sold off, let's say the value of the house was, pick a number, the house is worth $10,000, which you don't find anyways today. House is worth $10,000, but they got a value on it for $1.5 million because it's tied up with these other packages. And when it fell and when it crashed, there was nothing to back it up. It didn't have the capital foundation that it needed to be able to sustain itself to move through.
Right, right. And it's a huge mess, too. Sometimes people don't understand that your mortgage is not owned sometimes by the lender who's servicing it. So a lot of people think, well, Bank of America is my lender, but Bank of America might just be their servicer, and your loan could be in one of those pools, and it could be broken up and, you know, maybe owned by firefighters' pension funds. And really, who are they going to go ask if it's okay to modify your loan?
No, I hear you loud and clear now. Anna, we're starting to run out of time now. Let me ask you this. Website where we can find you at, buy the book, get more information.
www.askaloanmodguru.com.
Wonderful. Anna, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate you and, my goodness, the work that you're doing. Hey, go get them.
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, and on that website, I offer free tools. There's a blog on there as well, and there's a link there to the do-it-yourself service site so that people can create their own package to send into the lender and know exactly what the lender is going to see before they send it.
Wonderful. Hey, Anna, good night.
Good night. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Watch it, Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me. I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. got so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London, Siam, Vienna, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Daniel Haight with us. He is a full-time geek, and he's been that way for a very long time. He is the author of Flotilla, which is an e-book. He's a native of the San Francisco Bay Area. He first fell in love with science fiction, watching Star Wars and Star Trek before moving into other classics of the genre. He cites his major creative influences from a broad range of authors and genres, including Ray Bradbury, Elmore Leonard, and Hunter S. Thompson, and Chuck. I can't even say Chuck's last name. Let's say Daniel.
Palahniuk.
Thank you. I was having trouble with that one. By the way,
Don't worry about it. I had trouble, too.
Okay.
I had to go visit and look that one up on Wikipedia.
Science fiction, and I wonder sometimes if we don't talk about science fiction, science fact. Science fiction has captured people for years, and you and I have something in common. I was an old Star Wars and a Star Trek fan all the way from the very beginning. There was something about it that captured you. What is that special something that science fiction has and holds for people?
I think, in general, it is the art of possibility. People are excited to think about what might be and generally get their opinion and get their creative juices flowing thinking about what is possible. Because before we actually get to possible, we have to dream and we have to think about things in those terms. And that actually helps get us getting closer to where we actually want to be as far as people, technology, and different ideas.
Now, by the way, Flotilla, You were thinking about the ocean one afternoon, and it started to come to you. But realistically, when you think about it, how could you live in the ocean? What would you do to sustain yourself?
That's really what I struggled with when I first started thinking about it, because it kind of just came upon me in a daydream about what people would do, why they would go to the ocean, what they would want to do, and how they would they get lonely, were there practical things that they wanted to accomplish, why would they want to be away from land, things like that. So there were different questions that I started to kind of ask myself, and as I came up with those answers, it started to become more and more obvious that there was a story to be told there, and I was excited to find out what it was.
Now, symbolically, what does the ocean represent?
The ocean represents several different things, I think, Michael. It represents possibility, also represents danger. It represents something larger than humanity itself. And so, realistically, there are so many different things that it can be. People, it just captures their imagination, their fear, their hope, so that when Jim, the protagonist of Flotilla, goes to it, it really becomes this backdrop against all the different problems of his life, kind of take a step back and stop being so large and so major, and gives him a place where he can kind of begin again to become an adult.
Now, by the way, as a reader, where do I see myself? As an average reader, where do I see myself within the story?
I would hope that you find yourself wanting to be a member of this exciting colony and this experiment in humanity, as it were. Because realistically, the backdrop of Flotilla is that you can actually place yourself there. It's essentially a company-run town. And so anybody who wants to be a member of it and take a shot at it, they can actually come out and actually be on a shakedown cruise and give it a shot. If they make it and they want to make it a part of their lifestyle, then they have the opportunity to do so. That's what we talk about in the book.
Yeah.
So I would want you as a reader to see yourself as somebody who could potentially come out there, exist, get along, interact, and actually ultimately build a life out there. I want you to be in the story. I want you to place yourself in the story.
No, but by the way, do we see each other? Do we see ourselves in today's world? Because when you think about it, there's so much confusion in the world today. People want to run away. And when they run away, maybe not physically, but they run away emotionally. They hide themselves, some with drugs, some with alcohol, some with depression,
yeah.
Some with and all of a sudden, there is this brand new culture. There's this brand new microcosm of things that you can apply yourself to and create. Is that what we're looking at?
I think so, because in general, when you think about the way that people run away with Michael, that's a really important theme, I think, that causes the protagonist to actually be shipped off to the colony in the first place. He's getting out of rehab. He's a 15-year-old kid with a lot of alcohol problems himself. He gets shipped there forcibly, and yet it actually turns out to be the best thing for him. And when people actually want to leave, like the idea of seasteading in general is a idea of people who are dissatisfied with their current state of government. They want to create a culture of their own. They feel like they can actually create a sovereign nation out in the ocean. And so seasteading has a lot of appeal for people for that reason. Is it running away? Well, if the system itself is not working for them, then they want to have the ability to go out and create a new system. That is something I think that's intrinsic for all people.
You know, what I love about science fiction, and especially what you're talking about, there are people who just, they don't want to admit this is what they're afraid of, this is what they want to run to. And it was like they did with Star Wars, or not Star Wars, but, Star Trek. Thank you, I need that.
Yeah, exactly.
With Star Trek. Years ago, there was a bit actor, and his name was Frank Gorshin. Frank Gorshin was in a tremendous amount of movies and TV, et cetera, in the 50s and 60s, et cetera. There was one in particular, one episode that I'll never forget. He comes on the Enterprise. He's black on the left side and he's white on the right side.
Oh, I remember that episode.
He's scared.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, there you go. And he's frightened to death because they're after him. Why are they after him? Because they're black and white on the opposite sides. He's not like them. And what Star Trek did, they took today's problems, they took today's issues that we deal with, put them out whereby you could look at them and you didn't have to become part of it, so it wasn't you, to see how dumb it was. And that's what Star Trek did. Yeah, and I think that's what I'm hearing you're doing also. You're taking the issues of today, putting it out far enough where I don't have to say that's me, but at the same time, I'm seeing the possibility of stepping into a new world, and if it's not an ocean, it's a symbolic ocean.
Precisely. Yeah, no, I love that idea. I've heard many other famous science fiction writers talk about science fiction as a genre having the capacity to be the court jester of society. And it actually gives the ability, just like a court jester does, to actually poke fun without actually being taken too seriously, but give people a space to think about things that they would not normally think about or consider different ideas they would not necessarily take on. And that ultimately is very powerful and also something that people need this day and age.
Absolutely. And Daniel, I would venture to guess that, you know, with all the interviews I've done over all of these years, one of the things that I have found when somebody puts an idea, concept to pen, whether it's, you know, fact, fun, fantasy, fiction, whatever the case may be, there comes that time within the writing, there's this cathartic moment. There's this aha moment where you begin to realize something about the subject matter, a dimension of it that you weren't aware of. Where was that for you in the writing of this?
I think it was in the, I've had to consider that, but let me take a step back for a second.
Sure.
Really, the cathartic moment happened to be, for me, when Jim starts to really become an adult. He had some hard choices that he kind of stumbled himself into. He had some real problems, and like many young people, sometimes you come from a place where you make bad choices in your youth. You have an opportunity to move on, and you want to be able to put that behind you. I think writing this and giving Jim that opportunity was something that was very cathartic for me, and I really wanted to allow him to make the choices that I wish I had made when I was at his age. And so I think that really was the catharsis for me.
Yeah, and because when you really come down to it, and time and again when I've talked to authors that have put some very interesting things to pen, the book is you. The book is internally what you're expressing externally. Now, it may be, you know, 10 times the example of what it would be, but anybody who puts anything to pen, that's their life in there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. More than you care to admit.
Yeah, no, I got that. By the way, we'll keep it our secret. But when it really comes down to it, that's really what it is. And then if you put you into it, then the people reading it become it. And that, I think, is the success of a story. When the reader, the listener, the viewer actually becomes part of what they're being presented, where they can see themselves as one of the characters, living as one of the characters, recognizing the situations and conditions that they've been through in their life, maybe not to the degree, but that recognition and that triggering of that emotional reaction that says, oh, I got that. That's me.
Oh, yeah. No, I love that. That's a very powerful idea. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Yeah, and I think that's really what it's about. Now, the book in and of itself, when did it come out?
Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I mentioned originally that it was an e-book. I'm also pleased to say that it's also available in hard copy. So it launched as of last Friday, on Black Friday.
Now, by the way, is there a possibility of the book becoming a series?
No, absolutely, because the way we end the book actually has a tremendous amount of questions, and people immediately started banging me over the head going, what happened next? And I had to simply say, well, I wasn't thinking of it, but I guess I'm talking myself into it. We actually have to do a series. So absolutely, there will be another book.
Okay. Now, and by the way, what I believe in is you take books like this, and what you're really dealing with is this. You read the book, and then you go back and you reread it. The second time you read it, you're going to see it completely different from the first time, because you're going to have a little different understanding than you had the first time out. And then if you reread it again, it'll take you a dimension to a dimension to a dimension of perception that allows it to actually become alive. I really believe you take these kind of stories, they never end. And each time that you read it, there's more in it, you get more out of it.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the favorite things that I love about reading in general, because I can't be an author unless I love to read, is I love books that continue to hold my attention over multiple readings. And just like you said, multiple readings help you appreciate different dimensions, and I sincerely hope that everyone who reads Flotilla actually is continued to be engaged, even though those multiple readings help kind of pull out the deeper meaning that may not have been there on the surface.
Now, by the way, in the book in and of itself, is there a particular target audience, or is it a general audience? Will anybody from all walks of life find something about themselves in that book?
I think so, but I also wanted, when I originally wrote it, I was very firm on one particular idea, Michael, and that was that I wanted it to be something that was safe enough for kids to read. In other words, there's no sex, there's no drugs. I mean, the sex, the drugs, the violence, whatever it is very, you know, PG, PG-13 level. But at the same time, I wanted to keep that entertaining enough so that even the most jaded novel reader would still be able to pick it up and immediately get pulled into the story.
Yeah, and you know what, in today's world especially, if you can tell a story without, you know, there's always going to be some violence. Violence keeps people attached to it. But, you know, without the sex, without the drugs, without the rest of it, and really get into the guts of what it is that you're trying to say, what you're communicating to that audience out there. Now, the book is strong. I'm sure you've got a lot of great feedback. Do you think that it's going to turn into a motion picture?
I would certainly love to see this come to the big screen. I absolutely would. I think it's got enough interest, enough funny lines, enough great scenes that it would definitely make a wonderful motion picture.
Now, by the way, just for the heck of it, who would you see casted in it?
Casting? I was actually thinking, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was actually thinking about that today. The honest answer is I hadn't the slightest idea. I honestly think that what you're looking for is a 15-year-old actor, I should say, a young teenage actor who is perhaps ready to take a step into this type of role. And it literally could be anybody in general, but I was sitting here kind of like throwing out, would you actually put a famous person into this? And I candidly had to come back and say, no, I don't think so. Because when I'm writing these different scenes and the different characters in the novel, I'm not seeing a Brad Pitt. I'm not writing it according to what I know, you know, like a Spielberg movie or things like that. So I wasn't writing for specific people in the story, but I think they had some specific characters and names and faces. As long as the actor would actually fit within that role, they would be appropriate for.
Yeah, and you know who I'm seeing in this as you're talking, but it wouldn't happen because he's too old now. A very young Leonardo DiCaprio.
You know, I would actually take that one on, yeah. Actually, I can see that. Leonardo DiCaprio circa Growing Pains back in the 90s, right?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, but when he first started out, you know, I think one of the...
Yeah, absolutely.
Was,
yeah. Absolutely.
Money no, was, what was the, no, the movie he so. Was in where there were guns... No, not, no, before that. It was there were gunfighters.
This Boy's Life?
What was it?
This Boy's Life with the opposite Robert De Niro?
No, it was... they were what was his name in that? You know, 4 o'clock in the morning. I'll remember. I'll call you. Russell Crowe was in it. Russell Crowe was an ex gunfighter. He was a preacher, and they were having
The Quick and the Dead.
The Quick and the Dead. Yeah, absolutely. That was it. Yeah, and DiCaprio was a baby. Could have been more than 14, 15 years old.
Oh yeah, no, definitely, yeah.
See, that's
yeah, no,
what
definitely.
I was
no,
saying.
No, actually,
talking
that makes
about
a lot of sense
guy.
Now that you mention it. Oh yeah, yeah. I definitely dig it. Good.
Okay.
Excellent.
By
yeah.
the way, do you have? Great. We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website that we can find
yeah,
you?
Yeah. No. Actually, I have a special website just for fans of the Drescher Show. So if you'll go to www.flotillaonline.com/Drescher, you actually have a special landing page just for fans of the Michael Drescher Show. I created
wonderful.
That this afternoon. So Flotilla Online, Flotilla FLOTILLA Online, ONLINE.com/Drescher. You actually have a landing page right there for every fan of the Michael Drescher Show to come check out Flotilla. There's a sample chapter there. You can go to the Flotilla blog and you actually check out what the weather on the colony right now. And we try to really make that an interactive space that people can actually put and actually feel like they're a member of that colony.
Wonderful. As a matter of fact, we've got a place saved for you when the next book comes out.
Oh, excellent. I definitely look forward to it. And thank you for the time this evening.
Great. Hey, Daniel, thank you so much. Take care. Good night.
Thank you. You too, Michael. Take care.
Smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the...
I'm Michael Ray Drescher.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
I would spend it with you again, but now the curtain falls.